from rags to the promise of luxurious furs. On 12 May 1927, John was driving from Gippsland in a rented car, filled with what once was about 469 gorgeous opossums. Now their moist skins lay on top of each other, a blending of mountain grey and speckled black colours. John didn't know the police were told about the stock he hoped would fetch him £100. The police officers had seen the car at 1:30 in the morning on Franklin Street, and in order to pursue it, they had to first procure a car. This took them a little bit of time, so they caught up with him just before Morwell. Finally catching up to John as he stopped to get oil, Senior Constable MacDonald asked, "Is this your car?" John confirmed it was, for the time he rented it. The witness asked if he could have a look at what was in the car. The defendant told him, "There are a few skins." John could not provide a license, and it was not opossum hunting season. And they transported John back to Traralgon, where, on the ride back, he told them he expected to fetch £100 by selling them. MacDonald was incredulous and said, "Surely not. Is this your first offence?" John responded, "Oh no." The police counted the skins. On the first count, they returned 469. The second time they counted it was 492. The defendant informed he was expecting the season to open again and he was going to have 490 skins to start with. John was charged with illegal skin trading and the case went to court. Initially, John pled guilty until his lawyer advised him to change his plea to not guilty. This drew a lot of public interest and the courthouse was packed to hear the outcome of the case on the 3rd of June 1927. An expert witness for the prosecution, Senior Inspector Clift, examined the skins, determining they were the common mountain opossum, and some were freshly taken from the animals, while he conceded some were older. However, he testified there had been no season for opossums since 1911, 16 years ago, and John is not licensed. The lawyer stated the skins were stored very well. It was optimal conditions. I asked the listeners what they would say. Latrobe Valley Paranormal Detectives said, "Hunting out a season would be a huge fine these days, plus possible jail time." The court disagreed with the lawyer and imposed a £263 fine to be paid, which equated to about 5 shillings per skin, was in accordance with the Game Act. The court also noted that John's prior offence was for duck feathers, which were valued less than opossum skins. The lawyer requested John be given the opportunity to pay this off at monthly instalments of £5. The judge disagreed again, stating John had determined to profit and sell these skins, he needs to pay the fine in full. Interestingly enough, there is no equivalent jail time assigned to this if he did not pay. From stabbing animals to people. Kaloku, a man in his late 40s, originally from Albania, left his home country in 1927. He had lived in Traralgon since 1941, peacefully, I might add, and we know that because as a foreigner, at the time, if you were not a citizen, you had to report in every week under the alien subject law. So he was known well by police, and they reported him to be quiet. Kaloku had been drinking at the Grand Hotel in Traralgon from 2 p.m. on the 13th of January 1943. He loaned another patron there some money and required change for the loan. The man gave him 5 shillings. He also loaned another man money. A different person witnessed this action and believed Kaluku was taking illegal bets. Northwood, the publican, came and questioned Kaluku. Who believed him when he denied the charge? He had a few more drinks and went out of the hotel. Here, Temperance, a labourer, saw two men arguing out the front of the Grand Hotel in Traralgon. He asked, "What are you arguing about?" Kaluku told him to mind his own business, as he removed his glasses and placed them in his top pocket, then fought with Temperance. Now, this is where the two accounts occur. Kaluku, in his account, said Temperance asked him to remove his glasses and then proceeded to attack him. It appeared that many of the people at the hotel, including publican Northwood, did conduct betting. Although everyone was confident, no one was playing games of chance this day. Temperance had spent nearly 2 hours in the hotel, settling up his bill. He said he stepped out onto the street and heard someone coming up behind him. He glanced back and saw Kaluku, who pulled him into a headlock and drew a knife across his left shoulder, only to drive it in just below the spine, then drew the blade across his stomach. Gregory witnessed the assault on Temperance. Monaghan informed it was between a drunk and sober, as he made a decision to clout Kaluku, only to see him stabbing Temperance. Kaluku reported he'd been racially abused by the members at the pub. He said they said, "Kill the blank," which must be a super offensive or racist term for 1943 for foreigner. Constable Shields disarmed Kaluku in front of the 12 men, who stood gobsmacked at the scene that had befallen them, or so they said. Everyone there said there had been no provocation for this attack, even though one member of the crowd landed a punch on Shields. Shields, the constable, who was taking Kaluku off Temperance. The police officer took Kaluku to the Traralgon police station on the 30th of January 1943, where he took the statement and version of events. The police recorded that Kaluku had visible injuries, such as a lump under his left eye, an abrasion on his shoulder, which he said occurred when he was kicked by Morton. He stated the men were standing around the time the police arrived and had been assaulting him. In order to defend himself, he drew the razor, which he had forgotten was in his top pocket. He expected that this would cause the crowd to step back. However, he was angry and he had Temperance in his grip. He did admit to previously placing illegal bets in January with Northwood, Campbell, and another man because he was going to Moonee Valley to back a horse. The men believed it would win. However, it did not. So, Kaluku was attacked by Temperance earlier, and Constable Sloan had noticed that Kaluku's nose was bleeding all over his shirt and suggested he should go home, which Kaluku did and left his broken glasses at home and returned with the shirt he'd worn to the barber's the night before, who had loaned him a razor to shave with. So he returned to the hotel at about 4:45 and saw Temperance. He was planning to recover his reputation and had asked Temperance to see him after the last race. Temperance said, "You better see me now," while he punched him. Curran and the other men rushed him, saying, "Kill the blank blank. Kill the black blank." Kaluku informed he was not returning to cause trouble, but to restore his reputation and then lay charge against Temperance for the assault. The witness said Kaluku's attack was just as good as the attack against him. Temperance was able to get himself to a doctor who provided the police with a vest and shirt he was wearing, which had corresponding damage and blood on them. Dr. McLean determined the slashes resulted in a 10-inch long and 2.5-inch deep laceration below the spine, a 15-inch cut across his shoulder, and a long cut across his abdomen. I asked the listeners what they thought. Trev said he thought version 2 had more detail and sounded more credible. That was Kaluku's. Latrobe Valley Paranormal Detectives also chose version 2 sounding more credible, though it would seem it was in self-defense, so probably a fine or short jail term, not more than 6 months. Kaluku was charged with 2 counts of assault occasioning grievous bodily harm. The jury found him not guilty on assault. However, guilty on occasioning grievous bodily harm. His Honour, Judge Duffy, delivered a lenient judgment due to cultural differences. After all, Kaluku was an Albanian man. The judge said, due to his passion and excitement, he would only serve a sentence of 12 months imprisonment with hard labour. Kaluku exclaimed, "I am not guilty. I will appeal." He did. And Latrobe Valley Paranormal Detectives, you sentenced him. It was reduced to 6 months. The next case is about sedition. Sedition is conduct or speech inciting people to rebel against authority or state or monarch, such as not supporting the Australian war effort in 1915. 1915 was a bad year for Rudolph, 23 years old, father of a daughter who, in July 1915, he was fined 40 shillings for conscientiously objecting to vaccinating her. Thankfully, he was working as a letter carrier and telegraphist for the Postal Service. You know, the only one at the time, the Australian Postal Service. Rudolph was born in Australia. He was having a particularly bad day and was frustrated with his colleagues and friends. He said, "I would rather be ruled by the Kaiser than a drunkard, weak-kneed king." It's Tommy Rock for Australian boys to go and fight for England. In May 1915, the Lusitania, a passenger liner, was sunk by the enemy forces. Rudolph had an argument with his friends. "What about your British Navy now?" when people confronted him with the fact it was a war crime. He said, "Not to believe Winston Churchill or the press, they were paid agitators." Earlier on Belgian Day, 14 May 1915, a day to raise money for the people of Belgium who were suffering due to being at the epicentre of World War I. In Australia, it inspired such concern, badges were made and poems were written. Stay tuned for the end of the episode where I read a poem by Molly Bourne from Yass, New South Wales, another small town in Australia. That one's not too far from Canberra. However, for Rudolph, it rubbed him the wrong way. A colleague asked him if he would like to purchase a Belgian Day badge. Rudolph replied, "I have no intention of doing so." They walked out together. When Rudolph said, "Catch me buying the expletive things," the expletive Belgians can go to hell. If the Germans are beaten, it will not be by the dirty expletive British. So I asked the listeners what they thought would happen. Trev said it was treason. He didn't want to change his answer to a previous question. I did those in a different order on the live cast. He said he didn't want to change his answer, but he also thought this case could be a promising case for the death sentence. Latrobe Valley Paranormal Detective said it's an act of sedition, not full-blown treason. He probably would have been either fined or jailed, not interred in one of those camps, not because of his views, but only because he was not born of the enemy country. The Act of Sedition was repealed in 1921. The War Precautions Act 1914, which put the Act of Sedition as part of it, was an Act of Parliament which gave the Australian government special powers for the duration of World War I and 6 months afterwards, which is why it was repealed in 1921. Part of the Act was the Suspected Persons Inquiry Order in 1915, and that was for non-citizens. On the 24th of September, defence authorities took Rudolph to Langwarrin, Victoria internment camp, where he was to stay until the end of the war due to his seditious comments. However, An appeal was prompted by a petition and the law. He was let go in November 1915 with a good behaviour bond. The reason the good behaviour bond was given was because Rudolph's father, also named Rudolph, had asked for it, and six letters from prominent men were given. This enraged the Traralgon locals, who protested, including writing to other councils to ask them to condemn this decision. Several other councils joined Traralgon in condemning this decision, however it did not return him to interment. The Latrobe Valley paranormal detectives, because he was born in Australia, he was not supposed to be interred in one of those camps. It was not lawful to inter an Australian citizen. However, socially, as a result of his unpopular opinions, he ended up losing his wife, friends, two memberships in local societies, and his job at the Australian Post Office. The next two stories are about infanticide, or child murder. So if you want to skip until the next section, which it says on the description, you can. So the first one is about the child found in the Yarra River. Is it an accident, or did it occur on purpose? Clarence was 24, working for the Traralgon Railway as a fireman in 1917. He was seeing Millicent. She worked at the Traralgon Hotel. Millicent ended up going to Melbourne to have a baby and find a family to adopt it, as the baby was born out of wedlock. It would harm her social standing. She was in a maternity hospital in Richmond. On 22nd March 1917, Clarence visited her there, where she handed over Leslie at 3 weeks old. Believing Clarence had lined up a family, she later regretted this decision and asked Clarence who he'd given the baby to, which family, because she wanted him back. He continued to be avoidant, and her anxiety grew each time he refused to tell her where the baby was. He informed her he would never tell. Eventually, Millicent reported the baby as missing to police. On the 4th of April 1917, a baby was found fully clothed with a fractured skull in the Yarra River under the footbridge at Pump Road. Police confirmed this was Leslie James, the child Millicent had birthed. They met with Clarence and asked him about the baby. The police received contradictory statements from him until he landed upon a story. He said he sold the baby for £5 to a man in the Fitzroy Garden, who informed him he would place the baby with the family. An anonymous letter was sent to the presiding chief, Justice Madden, on the first day of trial, and Prime Minister Billy, or William Morris Hughes, Australia's seventh Prime Minister, and given to the Governor General, stating 27/5/1917, Fitzroy. Chief Justice Madden, knowing this is not worth the paper it is written on, my conscience makes me write about the accused man, Clarence, for the murder of his male child. He is quite innocent. Before God, my Maker, and my Judge, I must make this confession. My husband must answer to God for that baby's soul. But for the father, she writes his name in full again. The man who commits him must answer to God. His life's blood must not rest on my husband's hand. We are a childless couple. My husband is passionately fond of children. I have reared two children brought home to me, the same as this child in question was. As soon as they are in comfort and pleasure to me, to us, the parents claim them. Only 3 weeks before, my last little child had been taken from me. What I am writing is the truth. A solemn oath was taken before God. More solemn was never taken before man. As God is my judge. My husband brought the little baby to me on the night in question, and I told him I would not rear it for him, and he must take it back to whom he got the child from. With that, he took the child away. I never saw my husband again that night. The next day, he never went to work. I knew nothing until Saturday night, when I read in the newspaper where Clarence was arrested for murder of the child whose body was found in the Yarra. He had met this man by appointment, thinking if he gave him no address, they could never come and claim the child. When my husband took the child, the man gave him £5 and an address, Loco Sheds, Traralgon, and told him if the child wanted anything, that address would always find him. When I refused to have the child, my husband hurried out, thinking he must give the child back to the man. Hurrying through the gardens, he tripped, and I don't know if he fell on the child or if the child fell on his head. All he knows is that when he got up, partly stunned by the fall, the child never murmured. He picked it up and wrapped it, his coat around it, nursed the child for what seemed to him a terrible time. He dared not to do anything, being frightened, so he got some brown paper and rolled up the child's body and dropped it in the Yarra. I dare not sign this. If you take my husband, I will never live one day alone. It was a pure accident. That man, whatever he is, I don't know, never having seen him, is not guilty and is speaking the truth. I am only a poor working man's wife and don't know anything about the law. This was believed to be a diversion and not worth the paper it was written on, instigating an investigation for the writer. The facts of the case as the court saw it was Clarence had disposed of the child in the Yarra River. I asked the listeners what they thought. Trev believed this is the death sentence case. Latrobe Valley Paranormal Detectives said this is a tough one, either way, though there is a concealment of a death, which would certainly bring a jail sentence. Back to the court case. On 31st May 1917, Clarence was sentenced to hang until dead on the 16th of July 1917 in Melbourne. On the 13th of July, his sentence was commuted to life in prison. The penwoman of the letter attempting to pervert the course of justice was determined to be written by another barmaid from the hotel in Traralgon, Jean. She believed Clarence was innocent and was trying to help. The judge said justice needs to be uncontaminated. The jury found her guilty and she was remanded for sentencing. They discovered her because in the letters she wrote to the Prime Minister and Governor General, she had actually signed them and they were very similar with same handwriting. On 16 August 1917, she was sentenced to 12 months imprisonment, wholly suspended, providing she has good behaviour for 10 years. It appears she was never in trouble with the law again and remained a free woman. Back to Clarence's case 12 years later, it was brought to the public attention through a petition from a former prison chaplain from the Melbourne jail who'd recently taken up a post at Bairnsdale, Reverend W.A. Wilson. The petition ascertained that the evidence convicting Clarence was circumstantial and he has been of upstanding behaviour within the prison population. To be fair, the appeal did not say prison population. Although this leads me into a rant. Ranty McRanty time. Because it irritates me personally that behaviour in prison is taken into account, especially if the victim population or the victim demographic is not within the prison population. For example, in this instance, the victim was a child of his. Children were rarely in the prison, and even if they were, they were not allowed to mix with the general population. And if his victim was a woman, who again was not in the prison population or not accessible within the population, the behaviour in prison should not come into consideration. However, let's say he assaulted another man. Then, given he is surrounded by other men, if he does not assault other men while imprisoned with other men, that definitely counts. Anyway, that's my ranty McMarrant. Back to Clarence's case, and Clarence was released. He changed his name and was never in trouble with the law again. He also never married or raised his own family. He, however, was beloved by the family he did have. The next case is also of child endangerment with poison leading to the death of a child. Ivy was 22 and pregnant in July 1916 when her husband, Albert, 22, went off to war. This was the same year they were married. At the time, they were in Melbourne. Mona Lillian was born in August 1916. The next winter, Ivy and daughter moved to Traralgon, where Ivy took up a position as the servant at the Star Hotel. Mr. and Mrs. Rogers were the owners of the Star Hotel. Ivy complained to Mrs. Rogers that she was not earning as much money due to her caring responsibilities of Ivy, expressing she felt as though she was letting down her husband, as he was overseas, unable to work for the family, relying on the money from the soldier payments. Mrs. Rogers said, a few days later, Mona Lillian began to become violently ill, throwing up. Discoloration occurred around her lip. Mrs. Rogers said it looked like she'd been poisoned by Condy crystals. She went to the mantelpiece above the fireplace to find them. However, they were now missing. She said, Ivy, you need to take that child to the hospital and seek medical advice. Ivy said, no, she's fine. You know, she's just a baby. Babies throw up. There's nothing wrong with her. Ivy was so certain nothing was wrong with the one-year-old child. She went out. Mrs. Rogers, left to look after the child, was convinced something was wrong. The child threw up and became more and more disorientated and lethargic. Dr. McLean attended the home after Mrs. Rogers called him. After he examined the child, he believed she was poisoned. Her lips were swollen and discolored. The discoloration continued down Mona's throat. This is what happens when one uses Condy crystals internally, which is not an approved or suggested use. The doctor organized for Mona to be taken to the Sale Hospital. The doctor thought there was enough evidence to contact the police, who searched the property and found a bottle of Condy crystals wrapped up and tucked beside Ivy's bed that she shared with her daughter. Ivy's husband was informed of the death of the daughter he never met. This must have caused him some anguish, as he received an admonishment for threatening language in 1917 September. I asked listeners what they thought. Jenny said, this is the death sentence case. Other listeners were torn between this case as the death sentence case and the other one. Trav said this is an accident. The Latrobe Valley Paranormal Detective said, a severe case of negligence at the very least. And since the child died due to this, the mother should get jail time. Now we return to the court and how the past dealt with it. The coroner found enough evidence to charge Ivy with the murder of baby Mona and held her in remand until sentencing in December. The court date was brought forward from December and held at the end of October 1917. The judge said he could not see a motive for a mother who cared and raised a child for over 12 months to kill her daughter. The jury agreed with the judge and within 10 minutes acquitted Ivy. Acquitted Ivy. No penalty. Nerd note. Some people might say this is feminism at work. While in Australia, feminism began as a suffragette movement in 1899, it largely focused on getting women the right to vote, which, congratulations, Ivy could vote at this time, as could all white Australian women. The law had specifically excluded Aboriginal women and other Indigenous women of suspiciously black native homelands since 1902. Also, feminism is not asking for exceptional treatment, it is about equity. So in that spirit, I do think the judge and jury should have considered this more closely with the evidence. While I don't agree with the death penalty, this case does appear to be more active in causing a long drawn out death of the child. So to be fair, the death penalty should have been considered. The reason this occurred is because it's actually the work of the patriarchy. The judge, who himself is an archetype, he put on Ivy the model of the perfect mother. when this may not have been the case. Blada Jahar on safety said, "Patriarchy lays down the norms of upbringing, and women are supposed to live behind the facade of being natural nurturers when they may actually only be conforming to social rules laid down for them." This is why the judge could not fathom how a woman who is quote-unquote explicitly designed to care for and raise her child could harm her own child. And it is because of this assumption that he expected the nurture and nature would overcome any other desires Ivy had. As with all people, women are people and have a capacity, like Ivy did, to cause harm to their children. Statistically, it does not occur overtly this often. Ivy should have been punished for it, although it does appear she did not do this again. In 1919, Albert was medically discharged from the army with pleurisy. He returned home to Ivy, who was now living in Flemington. It's a suburb of Melbourne. In 1927, Ivy and Albert continued to live together as man and wife, where Albert was a leather worker. On to nuisance cases, a little bit more lighthearted. Today, the nuisance department would be part of the health department. We're still looked after in that manner. In January 1884, a complaint written to the local paper said the town was overrun by cattle. Sauntering all hours of the day and night. Where is the inspector of nuisances, it pled. The cattle droppings all over town were noted by a visitor who took great pains to discuss the texture when wet. I'll leave that for the listener's imagination. In September 1884, another letter of complaint written to the local paper was asking how the inspector of nuisances had not acted against an overpowering stench burning the nostril hairs of residents. The offending smell was suggested to be emanating from Mr. Breed's slaughteryard. Mr. Breed, the local butcher and Tarogan Shire representative since 1867, he started on the Rosedale Shire and then moved to the Traralgon Shire when it was formed. While the resident who wrote complaining about this also noted better drainage could improve the health of Traralgon residents, as a recent outbreak of cholera in Tasmania was determined to be due to the poor drainage. The letter writer also stated most inspectors of nuisances would not allow a duck pond, let alone the stench from the slaughter yard. This letter was signed Reform, after saying they were talking in the most friendliest of manners. Technological swindle using the telegraph machine. In 1892, this was cutting-edge technology, and Mrs. Dunn, working at the post office, was not trained in it. So when a well-dressed man said he was a telegraph operator from the head office in Melbourne, inquiring if he could contact his telegraph operator friends there, she allowed him entrance. Instead of just contacting friends, he wired two money orders, saying that £20 had been paid at the Traralgon Post Office, and signed them by Mrs. Dunn. As the Melbourne-based post office began reconciliation of the money, they discovered the names were fictitious. Mrs. Dunn, they learned she did not know Morse code, and did not know what messages were sent. I asked the listeners what they thought should happen. The Latrobe Valley Paranormal Detective said it's a bit of a head-scratcher, but if they caught up with him, it would be due to crimes against the government, which in 1892 would be a long stretch in jail with hard labour. How this was resolved? Well, the money was picked up by two other people on the other end, who went into the Melbourne-based post office and said they were those men. The criminals were not caught. However, a notice to the officials of post offices, especially the ladies of the post office, was issued to be wary and not allow people to use the telegraph machine. This crime was also repeated at other post offices across New South Wales, Victoria, and Tasmania. Robert, 14, was playing fox and hounds with his mate at the railway bridge over the Traralgon Creek after 8 p.m. on Thursday night. It was not clear who was the fox,
who was given a minute head start. Robert was supposed to lay down every minute or so when the whistle was blown, as the hounds were then released to follow their path and tag them out, when somehow he was struck by a bullet in the thigh. His friends took him to Dr. McLean's surgery. The pellet, believed to be shot from a pea shooter, went straight through, causing Richard to lose a lot of blood. The police returned to investigate the area the children used as their play area the night before and ask residents if they heard shots fired. Nobody had. There was no blood on the train track. This caused the police to begin to doubt the story the children had told. The police re-interviewed the children, who maintained the story. Richard was shot while running across the train bridge. At the very least, this would have been cause for charging them with trespassing on railway property. Police pounded the pavement in the main streets of Traralgon, trying to find the scenes of the crime, as there was no blood found on the bridge. The police started to look elsewhere and discovered splashes of blood on Seymour Street. They followed them and found a pool of blood outside Mr. By's bicycle shop. This, they determined, was the location of the shooting. There they started canvassing the residents in this street, when they were told they had seen a group of boys carrying another boy past. Police brought their findings to Richard, who was recovering at his father's house. Richard confirmed the story initially told was not the truth, and decided to bear it all now. One of the boys had brought a revolver to show the other boys. Once he'd shown it off, he put it back in his coat pocket. Then it discharged, piercing through Richard's thigh. Once they dropped Richard off at the doctor's, they ran off and threw the revolver in the river, fearing the repercussions of shooting their friend. It does not appear this shooting was considered a crime, and even though they'd not told the truth, it seems no charges were laid. The final crime I'm going to tell you about the Traralgon area is about a young man and a church. Albert, a young man of 20 years, on Sunday night, 6 May 1906, was hanging out with some friends. Two of these friends were of the furry kind, a dog and a kitten. He placed them on the porch of the Anglican church, the one that used to stand at the corner of Seymour Street and Church Street. The kitten and dog were not great friends. The dog started barking and the kitten bolted off into the sanctuary of the church. While Reverend Robert Elliot was holding a service, a congregant jumped up to catch the skittish kitten. However, it was too speedy and small. It scuttled around the pews. The Reverend could not compete with the catastrophe. He ordered the service over and helped to catch the kitten. Reverend Robert reported Albert and his pets to the police. This resulted in Albert facing the bench without his pets. It appears the animals were not charged or punished for causing a disturbance. Mr. Petit and Brinsmead heard the testimony, deeming it to be a severe offence of public disorder and against the noise codes. They imposed a £2 fine, which if Albert did not pay would result in him spending 3 weeks in prison. Thank you for listening to the first installment of Traralgon's Crimes. There are more on Patreon, including a carnal knowledge crime, another assault, domestic violence, more domestic violence. It's already there now. You can listen on patreon.com/hauntedhills. There are a lot more darker stories, yeah, but if you're up for that, come listen. Thank you, listeners, for your time and your ears. I hope you've had a fascinating journey through the Traralgon small town criminals. Not all of them were small time. I hope wherever you were, it was enlightening. This podcast was produced, researched, written and narrated by me, Tegan Dawson, on Gunai Kurnai land in Moi, Victoria, never ceded. The theme music by Aaron Austin Music. Next time on Haunted Hills, I'll be telling the ghost stories of Traralgon. This small town has big stories. I appreciate you all. Be kind, thoughtful, stay safe and healthy.